Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Good morning and welcome to BizRocket Radio. This is John Baker. Today, we are going to be talking to three individuals from Cressa, who is an organization that does commercial real estate. And as you all know, in BizRocket Radio, we get a chance to talk to business owners and executives here in the Atlanta area, learn from the challenges that they've had, some of the successes, the things that they've done to kind of better themselves and in their business and also with their clients. And today, the first person that I want to welcome in is Tom Tindall. Tom is the managing principal and actually was the founder of Cressa.
Yes, it was, John.
So welcome into the show.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that and appreciate you having us here.
It's our pleasure. So maybe you could tell us, Tom, a little bit about your background and how you decided to build the company and where it all came from.
Well, John, I started in commercial real estate 27 years ago. I'm originally from Atlanta. I've seen Atlanta grow quite a bit since I've been here. CRESA is the acronym for Corporate Real Estate Service Advisors. And from our perspective, we sit on just the user side of the table, that being the tenants. We were founded, the genesis of the company was put together 20 years ago by a gentleman named Bill Goad out of Boston. Bill originally was an in-house real estate executive with Digital Equipment. He stepped out and took on some assignments representing Digital. And back then, corporate America did not outsource their assistants. They all had large in-house real estate departments. So that was really a trend that was starting called corporate outsourcing. Bill had about 15 national accounts beyond Digital. We just happened to do some of their business here in Atlanta. There were a lot of other partners around the country who were of similar mindset, that being a user advocate. And we all initially got together. We started the company 18 years ago and completed our roll-up 12 years ago.
And how have things been going since then?
It's been very good. We've grown, you know, in leaps and bounds, quite frankly. Right now, we're the largest tenant rep company in North America.
Wow. So how many cities are you in right now?
We've got 55 offices around the country.
Wow.
So as well as Canada.
All spread out just from this little old spot in Atlanta, huh?
No, actually, it started in Boston.
Oh, okay.
So we were just the Atlanta partners at that time.
Gotcha. So Tell us a little bit about the company and what you guys do differently. Kevin, who I was speaking with a little bit earlier, who's going to come on in a minute, we were talking about experiences that tenants have when they go in. And I just did this myself. I just signed a lease 2 months ago for a space that I'm going to be getting into. And, you know, it was really the first time that I had done it. I had been involved a little bit in it probably 5 years ago in another space that I had been in, but you don't really know what you're getting into necessarily, and you don't really know who really to go with. What makes the difference between a strong tenant rep and somebody who's just there to collect the commission?
Let me first start with a differentiating factor of Cressa in comparison to some of our competitors here. Most of our competitors are what are called full-service real estate companies, which means they do land brokerage, they do development, they do investment sales. The tenant representation side is only a sliver of what they do. But they also represent landlords in buying buildings, managing those buildings, leasing them, and selling them. We do not do that. We've given up that side of the equation to be truly a consumer advocate. Clark Howard would be proud of us.
He'd be on your side, right?
Absolutely. So all of our resources and all of our education goes strictly to the tenant side. This is all we do. This is exactly what we do. Where we're a little different, we're a little bit more analytical. We're a little bit more strategically aligned. From our perspective, to do it right, you have to have a strategic plan. You have to have the right skill sets in that plan that help build that plan. Some of those are project managers. And there's a difference in a tenant project manager and just somebody that another group pulled in from the building management side of the equation. They have to understand how you use space. So going back to creating a strategic real estate plan that aligns with your business plan is one of the critical factors, and that's very important to us. It's the old carpenter's adage, measure twice, cut once. From our perspective, you got to understand how you're using the space, what your budget is, does the location work. We do scattergrams for where your employees live, where your customers are, where your competitors are, so that your real estate ultimately works for you. Most people look at it differently. They look at the building, they like it. Can we afford it? Gosh, that's great. We can get some free rent and off we go. They really don't study the real need that they're shooting for within their real estate.
And how complicated does it get as the size of the company increases? I mean, you talk about somebody that's got 5 or maybe 10 employees all the way up to, 100 or thousands. I would imagine it gets a lot more complicated as you get into those larger spaces.
It really does, and we sort of break it down into 3 user groups. One we'll call a one-off, and that's a group, anybody from 5 to, 300 employees that have one location. The second group we call a portfolio account, and that's one that might have one real estate director and multiple offices around the region or around the country. Then you'll have a corporate service account, and that's a large corporation that has a real estate department, and we become that attachment or the adjunct to that real estate department. They need transactional information. They need strategic skill sets. They need project management to tie in with the program that they already have in place.
What's the time frame that you typically recommend for people to get into that mode of, all right, the lease is coming up? When do they need to start looking at it? 3 months, 6 months, a year? How early?
Actually, I've got a meeting this afternoon with a gentleman whose lease does not expire for 2.5 years. We've already agreed to restructure that lease with the landlord. This is a large financial investment entity with multiple offices. I'm working on another one in Kansas City right now, same situation. There's a big misnomer that you can't do anything with your lease until the lease expires. That's not true. You can't relocate, and you still have a lease obligation until it expires. If you need to restructure your lease with your current facility, you can do it. We're sometimes doing 2.5 years out. So a lot of people look at the mindset of how many months prior to the lease expiring. If it were just a straight transaction with one office, we'd ultimately look at it 2.5 years out, evaluate it 2 years out, and then for a real relocation, it needs to be about 12 months out to start all the practical planning.
Right, doing all the, like you said, the scatter diagrams and figuring out where and what's the best location and what does the facility need to look like.
One of the things that we pride ourselves on is educating our client. Once again, we're consumer advocates. To really bring leverage to bear, which is the advantage of the tenant, is you have to start early. You have to understand what you need. You have to understand how you're using the space. Then you can go to the market that where your office needs to be located and look at all the alternatives. Certain landlords can do things that others cannot, based on how they're funded, based on how their success in leasing. There are a lot of different issues that come to bear that you certainly don't want to push off the table just because you waited too long to get into the market.
All right. Well, great. That's a great introduction. We're going to come back to you in just a second. Our second guest is Kevin Creel, And Kevin is a managing principal also at Cressa. Welcome in, Kev.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Kevin, I know that before the show we were talking about your experience in the industry. I think you've been in it 26 years?
Yeah, going on my 27th year.
So tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you came to Cressa.
Well, I have a varied background. I didn't start off in real estate. When I got out of college, I got into the computer industry with a Burroughs Corporation, who is now Unisys. And after that, I went into marketing with Coca-Cola and called on the bottling plants and helped advise them on their business practices. And then went into the medical business on California, and I wanted to come back home to Atlanta.
Wow, you're bouncing all over the place, huh?
Absolutely.
Experience, jack of all trades.
So I got it. The great thing about that was I got to experience different types of the business, from the accounting flow to the distribution to marketing to promotion. So when I sit down with a client, I look more at their business than I do with their real estate and help match that real estate with their business plan.
And you've been doing this for 26 years?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So how did you come to Cressa? How did that come to bear?
Well, I was recruited to come back to Atlanta by a former friend of mine who formerly worked with me at Coca-Cola. And I worked for a large local brokerage firm that was a full-service brokerage firm. However, we started out as a tenant rep firm. And as the firm started to change and get into the full-service business, I started to run into conflicts of interest, where I was representing a client and my owner was also representing the landlord. And it got to be a point where my clients started to question my integrity and ethical relationship in that negotiation. So I made a determination to look around and try to find a company that was solely focused on the tenant and also met the ethical requirements that I was looking for.
That seems like you found a home 10 years ago here.
Yes, I did.
Oh, so that's great. So tell us a little bit about, from your experiences in being in this side of the business, what's the difference really with the experience that a client gets working with you guys at Cressa?
I think it's a holistic approach. Tom mentioned the strategic approach. It's very important that we understand the client's business. Traditionally, most clients, you probably went through this yourself, all of a sudden realize their lease is coming up, and they'll pick the phone up and call a broker and say, hey, I need space. I need approximately 3,000 feet to 5,000 feet, and I need to be in this area. And so they go start a survey and go do that. We recommend that you sit down with your client, you understand their business, find out what their short and long-term goals are, and then try to match those goals with the real estate. Many times, as Tom mentioned earlier, waiting to the lease expiration is not the time. Most businesses don't wait for lease expiration. They do it based on business. In the past 3 or 4 years, there's been a lot of consolidations. Well, when you're having a consolidation going on, you cannot wait for your lease expiration. You've got to look at what's in the best interest of the company. So the important thing that we try to drive home is a lease is part of your business, and you got to make it as flexible as you can make it. And the landlord wants you to sign a long-term lease. They don't want to make it flexible. So there's a natural discussion there, a negotiation that goes on there. We really push hard to make sure that those flexibility and those lease rights are there for the tenant.
Well, give me an example of a flexibility piece that you'd really say, hey, this really should be in the lease that most people don't know to ask for.
Well, there's several things, really. One is first right of refusal, just in case of expansion.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a larger client, probably expansion options, where you make the landlord reserve space for a period of time. Just in case. There's contraction options, just in case your business is going the other way and you want to get out.
Right.
And then ultimately termination options. So if you can plug a termination option in, let's say midway through that lease, then you're not stuck the whole term. It's going to cost you something to get out, but it's an insurance policy that you pay on only when you use it.
Right, which is certainly a good thing to have as a business owner. You always want to think about the positives and then also, you know, what could go wrong. So we're going to come back to you in a second, Kevin.
Okay.
Thanks for that intro. Our next guest is Akiva Freeman, and Akiva's vice president with Cressa as well. Had been in Atlanta. I think this is your second stint in Atlanta. So welcome back.
Thank you much. I'm glad to be back.
Back from Cincinnati, right?
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came here.
Well, again, I'm originally from Cincinnati, Ohio. I got my start in the commercial real estate industry in 1998 with a national developer, and learned the business from the landlord-owner side. Spent some time in Cincinnati, then moved to Indianapolis, and came to Atlanta in 2003. Worked here on the landlord side from 2003 through 2009 before heading back to Cincinnati to start my career with Cressa.
So you've got experience on the other side of the table, which
That's
is
correct.
The landlord. You're the one across the table from these guys.
Well, that
right
is
now
correct.
You're not. You came to the dark side, right? Or the light, the good or, side.
That's right. I saw the light.
You joined the force.
That's right.
So from a landlord perspective, mm-hmm. You know, what are they going into these lease agreements trying to create and figure out? What are they trying to get out of the deal?
Well, typically, you know, from a landlord perspective, the lease document is going to reflect the ideal terms for the owner. So that's the starting point.
Right.
And so, you know, typically what tenants have to understand is when they start the process, when you get a lease document, you're starting from a vantage point that the landlord has all the cards, and you're effectively trying to make some changes that benefit you in that process. But effectively, your starting point is from the landlord's most advantageous position.
Right. So they're like, yeah, we'll draft the documents. No problem.
That's right.
You don't need to worry about
that's
that.
Right.
We'll take care of that all for you.
Well,
like,
and most of it is relationship-based. I mean, what you want is you want that tenant to feel as though, hey, I'm your best bud. I've got your best interest at heart. But the reality of the situation is from a landlord's perspective, your task is to maximize the value of the property, which means you want to get the most rent possible with the least amount of lease flexibility, as Kevin mentioned, because those are encumbrances on the lease. So no matter if you're looking at it from a vantage point of your continued ownership, if you want to put the property on the market, the least amount of encumbrances that you may have on the lease affect the value of the property.
So your experiences in Cincinnati and Atlanta, just curious, what's the differences between those two markets, working in those two markets in this industry?
You know, I think Atlanta, you know, overall is a much more progressive market. One of the things that, I found of interest was when I'd moved to Atlanta, I didn't really have a concept of tenant representation. You know, my previous markets were really Cincinnati and Indianapolis. And moving to Atlanta, tenant representation was really something that was completely different for me. I had never had any experience with Cressa, hadn't heard of Cressa before I had moved here back in 2003. And, you know, my experience with tenant advocates, you know, Cressa being, you know, one that I dealt with on multiple occasions was, man, this model makes a lot of sense. You know, from an ownership perspective, I work for the owner. I'm trying to do a deal with the tenant. And, you know, I'm working with a tenant who may not have a broker or may have a broker that represents other properties. That broker's got a lot of irons in the fire. Whereas with Cressa, the firm that's a tenant advocate, that's their sole focus. And typically the Cressa brokers were the most tenacious brokers that I dealt with on the landlord side. You know, I'm not saying this because Kevin's here. Kevin and I worked on a deal, and he is an extremely aggressive negotiator and takes great care of his tenants and or of his clients. And there were some brokers that I dealt with on the landlord side that just were not as aggressive and assertive taking care of their clients.
Well, I can tell you from a client's perspective, you know, as a business owner, you're going into the deal. That's not your job. You know, you make money in another place, and you're trying to bring somebody in that's going to represent you. But a lot of times, all you're just getting somebody that's going to show you around and hopefully find a space for you that's okay. But the negotiation side of the coin, a lot of those guys just don't do that. Is that not true? That's kind of a general question.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, when you have somebody that's representing you for finding space, and you find a space, and then the contract comes out, and the contract, like Akiva says, is generated by the landlord, kind of fighting for the things that you should be fighting for sometimes doesn't happen. Is that the case? Or
let me touch on that, John. I just had that situation in Kansas City, and we're trying to rectify it right now. The former broker stepped in, had a buddy-buddy relationship with the landlord, so the service he provided was more of a tour guide. He helped them locate it, left them at the door, and off they went. Mm. After going through the lease, we have found, and this was 5 years later because they had some issues, we have found that they left over $700,000 on the table. So as you can imagine, the landlord loved them, was very, you know, very buddy-buddy-ish with the local manager. Well, now that we've gotten involved on an expansion and an extension lease on the lease with them, the landlord initially did not like us because he knew that we were going to pull the curtain back on his little act that's been going on.
Right.
The CFO was fuming when we identified this, and then we compared his lease to other buildings in the market. It was a good bit higher, but it's typically not the rental rate where the landlord takes advantage of the tenant. In this case, it was a tenant improvement allowance and the liabilities that were in the lease. We do not practice law, but we read leases in our sleep because we have to. We're the conduit between the business issues and the legal issues. We always recommend that our client gets not only an attorney, but a real estate attorney, not a residential real estate attorney, but somebody who practices in our world, because there's certain relationships between the landlord and the tenant that attorneys that specialize in this know exactly what we're looking for. But they have to understand the business issues that we've negotiated. So that's why we read the leases. I just sent comments on the Kansas City transaction just this morning. But once again, we have found items such as corporate guarantees that should have never been in there. We saved a client over $1 million a year ago in a corporate guarantee that when we renewed the lease, we just said, that's unacceptable. We're not going to have that. Landlords know what they're getting away with, because one of the things we help our clients with is understand, and Akiva touched on it a moment ago, understand the investment of the building on behalf of the landlord. If you don't know what the landlord is doing with his investment, you would never know how to negotiate against it. And I use the word against softly. You don't want to beat the landlord up so bad that he's unhealthy, because if he's not healthy, the building is not a good environment for your client.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be, and you hear this cliche over and over, but it has to be a win-win scenario. But it shouldn't be the landlord taking advantage of an uneducated consumer.
Right, right. Good point. So the market, the real estate market in 2008 got pretty much hammered, and I think things have maybe slowly started to recover, but things certainly seem to be slow still. What is your viewpoint on how the real estate on the commercial side market is here in the Atlanta area?
Well, I'll touch on that a little bit. Most of the big asset sales were done in 06, 07, and 08, and it was the top of the market. So a lot of the investment community bought and paid the top dollar in that market. And when the shoe dropped in 08, there was vacancy that happened, values dropped, and so it put a lot of pressure on the landlord situation, which, quite frankly, in my 27 years, had never happened. Landlords were never in trouble. Now they're in trouble. So it changed the landscape on how a tenant should look at not only his existing building, but also going out and look at other buildings. We've had to up our due diligence with regards to landlords. We're tracking the marketplace with regards to their situation with their lenders, and we've instituted certain provisions in leases to protect the tenants in the event of landlord default. So there's things that have changed in the marketplace just because of that one issue. The other issue is, and I mentioned it earlier, was about consolidations between industries. A lot of industries are buying competitors, and there's a lot of merging going on. So the cultures were changing, the space requirements were changing, and it required looking out in the future, as Tom mentioned, doing restructures or looking at cancellations and trying to get out of those markets. But the important thing for the tenant was that they understood the landscape of that landlord before they entered into a relationship with them.
And now that, I would imagine, continues to be a major issue.
Especially this year, let's see, in 11, 12, and 13, there is probably more buildings maturing, their loans maturing in the next 2 years than there were in the last three.
Wow.
So it's putting pressure. There was a building that just went foreclosed 2 days ago that's 98% leased.
Oh, my gosh.
So those kind of things are just unusual.
So what happens to a tenant that's in that situation?
Tom and I had this conversation last night. The tenant, one of my clients, called me up and said, what do we do? Well, in talking with some attorneys, there's one of two things. If the tenant has a subordination non-disturbance clause in their lease, they're protected. You know, there's two things. There's a legal issue and there's a logical issue. Legal issue is the building goes back to the lender, and the lender has a choice. He can either kick those tenants out or basically bring somebody in to buy the building that wants the whole building. So from a tenant's perspective, he's got a business to run. He doesn't want to worry about that. He wants to make sure there's some...
The lights are on.
The lights are on and everything's taken care of. You know, being serviced and this, that, and the other. And his lease will go forward. You know, in this particular issue, my client called me up and wanted to renegotiate. They see an opportunity to renegotiate.
Right.
Well, he's got 4 years left on his lease. I'm not so sure there's a time to renegotiate. So if we go to that landlord, the landlord has two choices. Okay, I'll either renegotiate or you're out. And by the way, you're going to be out in 30 days.
Right.
So it becomes a situation, well, I'm not so sure I really want to negotiate that, or do I really want to play that game?
Right.
And then if you want to get out, then it becomes a legal issue of really what's in that, you know, what was in the security deed before we signed the lease, and how does that affect the tenant? So there's a lot of issues. It's more than just a real estate issue. It's not only it's running your business, but it's also looking at the legal issues and then a real estate issue.
Well, you would imagine a bank would the most valuable part of a commercial real estate office is not necessarily the building itself. It's the leases. If you got 98% occupancy, what you want to do is maintain those occupants so that the rent keeps coming in. Is that not the case?
Let me touch on that. Not necessarily. Because keep in mind, there could be a percentage of the building's rent roll that is paying on that they've renegotiated their leases, and they're paying a very low rate.
Oh yeah,
that landlord might not, as Kevin mentioned, he can't even cover debt service on that. So you have the lender who comes in, and the lender looks across the tenant stack and says, "Gosh, 85% of these tenants I want to keep because I like the rent they're paying. We've already spent the money on their tenant improvements. We want to keep them, but there might be 15% that are way below the market." Well, if that's the case, he might be better off letting them go. Then when he goes to sell the building, there's an entire group looking at what's called value-added opportunity,
mm-hmm.
meaning they don't want a coupon clip building with, you know, 98% leased. Right. They want something that's more 70% leased, because then the leases that they will be signing once the free rent burns off in an improving market will be at higher rates. Those higher rates are going to dictate much higher value if they go to look to either refinance or sell the property.
So if I'm a business owner and I'm looking at trying to figure out where I want to have my office, what's one of the things, Tom, you had talked about earlier is interviewing and understanding what these people are really looking for and what's going to be right for them. What's one of those questions that you guys tend to ask all the time that tenants don't seem to think about? They don't ask that question of themselves, but when you ask it, it uncovers all sorts of good stuff.
If you look in the mirror, you're not verbalizing it. You're just internalizing it. We try and get them to verbalize it. What keeps you up at night? What are the issues that you're having as it relates to your location or your budget or the functionality of your space that could be improved? Keep in mind, when you're working in the space, typically you're so busy that you can't really put your finger on those issues. We live off of those checklists. Why? Because what we want to do is minimize the time to help them get to the answers. Well, if we don't ask that and we race out to the market just based on a square footage and we don't know how they use the space or what's important to them, we're wasting their time and our time, because ultimately those questions will come up. We will have wasted the time looking at properties or discussing issues that just aren't important to them.
Well, when it comes to the consulting side of business in general, I've heard this cliche a lot. You mentioned cliches earlier. You know, what keeps you up at night? We've all asked it in various levels of consulting, but the other cliche I'll throw behind that is you don't know what you don't know. So how do you go to these tenants out there and help them understand what they don't know? How do you guys go and engage them to say, hey, there's probably something that should be keeping you up at night, but you don't know about it, and we can help you figure that out and provide all these great services? Because as I'm listening to it, it sounds like you cover the gambit of so many things tenants need. How do you reach them?
Well, I think the toughest thing is most tenants are not proactive. They're busy running their business.
That's right.
So by trying to engage ourselves early as on a consultative basis and trying to stay in touch with them, we try to have meetings with them a couple of times a year to understand where their business is going. So we try to become part of that executive team. Once we understand where they're going with their business, we're doing enough transactions with enough different types of companies out there and knowing what they're running into in terms of their business, we can bring those examples to bear. And it helps bring another outside source to their business that makes them think a little differently than what's going on, because we touch all different business industries.
Yeah, and I just want to follow up on that to further elaborate on Kevin's point. You know, another cliche is that we're more relationship-based than transactional. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you have that relationship with either a prospect who has not become a client or a client, that you're more in tune to what their needs are and they're more receptive to the things that you're communicating to them. If it's a dog and pony show, everybody's come to the table. Sometimes you're really left at their own understanding of the process and how well you hit on what their particular expectations are. But when you actually have a relationship with the individual or the individuals who are tasked with making the decision, then they are, they are more receptive to kind of feeling like, hey, you're a part of the team as opposed to just someone that's trying to collect a check.
Well, give me an example of that, because you hear that, services is said by most people. They're great service. They keep in contact. They do all these great things. Give me an example of why some of the things that you guys are doing that makes you different.
I'll just give one really quick example. I had a client that wanted to buy a building. And through my meeting with the client, really evaluating what their expectations for their business, growth were, where they were, what they wanted to accomplish, one of the things that I had figured out was buying the building wasn't in that client's best interest. Now, from a fee setup, I would have made more money saying, okay, you want to buy a building, let me just go out to the market, find you a building, we'll buy it, and whether or not that works for your business long range or not is not really my concern. My concern is getting paid. My concern was my client and what was in the best interest for their business. And so through understanding that, we were able to figure out that really what made sense for them to do was to do a short-term lease, to figure out how that fit with their continued growth plans, and then decide if buying at a later date was more advantageous to them.
One of the other issues is keeping our clients up to date on trends in the market. Right now, or I would say for the last few years, we've been restructuring a lot of leases. There are a few reasons for that. Number one is a lot of our tenants have needed to contract because they were letting some employees go. But number two is back in the years prior to 2008, there was a lot of expansion. The market was tight. There were leases signed at a higher rental rate. Well, I'll go back to why you look at it a few years out. If we can go back and restructure the lease that they have, they don't go through the headache of relocating. They don't spend the money on doing that as well, and we can restructure the lease and, oh, by the way, drop their rental rate $4 to $5 a foot and then maybe even drop the square footage if they don't need it. But what do we give the landlord? We extend the term, so it gives the landlord a term that will either increase the value of the building or increase their ability to refinance the loan on the building. Those are the things that we keep them up to date with. Once again, they're not thinking of these things. Mm-hmm. But better yet, a lot of the people we interact with are the chief financial officers. Those guys are, if you look at their tenure, they typically stay in a position 3 to 4 years, and then they're gone.
About the time for a lease, right?
Right. But their issue is, how can they be the most cost-effective on the profitability of the company? Well, the profitability is driven by revenue less expenses. If we can drop the expenses, we just found that chief financial officer the capability to improve his profitability that he might not be thinking of. And we do that whether it's a one-off user or across a whole portfolio of offices. Once again, they don't have the time to do that. We have the time and footprint and the expertise to do it.
How often are you bringing that to their table? Are you still every 6 months? Are you saying hello? Let's go have lunch. Let's talk about what's going on. Are you going in and visiting? How does that work?
When it's appropriate for them. Because they'll let you know. You can either tell they're so busy with mergers and acquisitions or refinancing some of their debt, they don't have time for this. But it's our goal to stay in touch, I would say, every 6 months to stay in touch with them. We run the analytical component of it so that we can touch a number. We can say, gosh, does that make sense for you? We just ran one, as a matter of fact, a meeting this afternoon. We saved him over $550,000. Pretty happy camper.
Yeah.
Once again, it's found money because the alternative to that, one of the alternatives, is to let go of employees. Well, that's a very uncomfortable thing.
Right.
So if we can keep them in their space, lower their occupancy cost, and have them or create the ability for them not to take other drastic measures, they enjoy what we do for them.
All right. So let me change gears just for a second and talk a little bit about areas. What right now seems to be a very popular hot area for businesses to want to get space in, and why?
I'll touch on that because I just had the conversation the other day. Buckhead, believe it or not, as the perception is that it was overbuilt right as Kevin says, as the shoe dropped, and the answer is that's correct. It was one of the most overbuilt submarkets in the country for Class A-plus space. Well, a lot of those buildings have filled up. Did they fill up at the rates that the landlords had performed for their investment? No, not at all. But they're full, and a lot of the free rent period's burning off. Hmm. So those buildings are becoming more healthy. There are not large blocks of space in that submarket anymore in those types of buildings. We even had one of the landlords who basically quit leasing. Why? Because he would rather wait 12 months and lease at a higher rental rate than he would sign a deal with a large tenant at a lower rental rate for a 10 to 12 year lease.
So he's kind of betting on the fact that market will come back in 12 months.
And it is. Yeah. And it is. And not in leaps and bounds, but if you look across the Buckhead A-plus market, it's becoming tighter. What is that doing? It's having pressure on rental rates. It's even, and I'll say this, I had lunch yesterday with a landlord in that market. They've got a pad site. They are out marketing to build another building. Will that happen right away? No. But there are larger users that need space in that submarket. Ultimately, that will come about. And the few people that have pad sites will be out in front of the rest of the development crowd.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed is when we're doing our surveys for these clients, that it's all about blocks of space. And like Tommy said, there's large blocks of space that have been taken off the market. Well, in addition to, you may have a market that says they're, you know, 20% vacant, but that particular block of space may not exist in that market, or maybe just a few spaces, much like what you experienced by losing two spaces during your search.
Right.
And the impression is, because they read the papers and they see how bad it is and this, that, and the other, the impression is that we got plenty of time, we know how to do this, it's going to be easy, there's a million brokers calling on me every day, so somebody can pick up this job and take it. The problem is not being proactive and understanding the market. And so much, and if you go back to 91 during that recession, when UPS decided to move here, we had a market full of empty space. But as soon as UPS decided to relocate here, all of a sudden feeder fish started coming, following them, and this market dried up really quick. Hmm. So we've got a number of folks looking at Atlanta, Georgia, because Atlanta, in terms of the marketplace in the United States, is one of the best deals going, not only from a residential perspective, but also from a commercial perspective. So I have a feeling that somebody's going to move here, and we just had a couple of big announcements of the folks moving here. And when that happens, all of a sudden the market dries up quicker than you might think.
I mean, it just from the conversation, it sounds to me like you guys are saying that you're already seeing a significant recovery or starting to have recovery in the commercial side. Is that happening across the board, or is that just in certain markets?
You got to be careful when you use the word recovery. What we're seeing is activity amongst the tenants. Keep in mind what Kevin said about the investment perspective from the landlords. That's not a recovery because there's so much debt that's maturing right now. And that's problematic. One of the things, and if it's a trend of some of the things that we're now doing for our clients and spending more time, as Kevin had mentioned, is doing the due diligence on the landlord. Most of that has to do with the debt structure.
Right.
We fully have to understand that because we've even seen leases that you sign the lease, tenant's obligated to pay the rent, landlord's obligated to provide the tenant improvements and the rental concessions, and oops, they didn't have the money to provide the tenant improvements. Now, that is few and far between, but there's more of that going on to where it used to be, from an investment perspective, the landlord needed to get real comfortable with the tenant's security. Now it's the other way around.
Yeah.
We need to understand how secure the landlord is.
If you are a, and the way you guys advise your clients in dealing with signing a lease or going into the next lease, how do you know, or how do you get a feeling of whether a market is becoming tight, whether the prices that you're locking into right now are a bit higher than what they probably should be? And then if that's the case, how do you counteract that? How do you defend against it?
Well, I think you look at the activity in the marketplace. Like Tom mentioned, there's a lot of activity going on. There's a lot of closings that are happening. And so that is a very quick understanding. What I try to tell tenants all the time is, listen, good space will go in good markets and bad markets. But bad space only goes in good markets. And so if all of a sudden the spaces that weren't able to lease for the last 4 years are starting to lease, that's a good indication that the market's changing and you need to be active in looking at your options.
Let me also add to that. I'll go back to the strategic planning stage. You don't always have to look in a specific submarket, because are there alternatives to your space needs? The answer may be that you split and have two locations. The answer may be that you have a strategy to where you're looking at half the size with the right to expand into the balance of the space. Keep in mind, there are strategies in which we help our clients implement that if it's a tight market, we know how to get around that. It doesn't mean that we have a full effect on the final outcome, but we certainly know how to put them in position to get what we'll call the best deal in the market.
And the most obvious telltale sign is new development. So we, you know, when you see new development, whether it's office or industrial product, what that means is that the developers have figured out that the market has tightened enough that there needs to be more supply. So that's the easiest, most obvious.
Well, where are we in that cycle right now? I mean, there was a report not long ago that that we saw came out that said there's what I think $6 billion worth of distressed or foreclosed commercial property in Atlanta right now. What is that doing to the market as we see it?
I think, again, it depends, and you know, Kevin and Tom have both hit on this point. It's really market specific. You know, some markets have significant amount of vacancy, and those owners are in, you know, pretty dire straits in terms of their lender relationships. But there are other markets that are performing well. There are good assets that are performing well, and the ownership of those groups are going to continue to make deals.
We're seeing that in the residential market as well, where certain markets are thriving and closing, and yet others are a lot of vacancy is happening right now.
It's true. It kind of goes back to the location thing. It's always, that's the key, right? That's if that area is a hot market, it doesn't really matter what the rest of the areas are doing. People want to be where they want to be.
Well, that and it's also demand driven. I mean, we're working on some assignments up the I-85 corridor from an industrial capacity. Right. And if you're looking at, you know, options that are between 30,000 and 120,000 square feet, there are lots of options. Once you get north of 250,000 square feet in terms of a need from an industrial use, your options become much more limited.
Do you guys do anything on the, the political side, the lobbying side, maybe working with some of the local governments, et cetera, that are really trying to promote economic growth in their areas? I mean, like, for example, we're in North Fulton right now. I know they're doing a lot of things, transportation and otherwise. Are you guys involved in any of that activity?
We don't as much. When we do that, we typically work with the state, because the times that we need their input is if we have a client moving into the state and we need the state to compete with other state municipalities. Mm-hmm. But from a local perspective, and we'll call it a county perspective, they don't have as much impact on a user as, I mean, they might ultimately, but it typically starts at the state level.
How does Atlanta compare to other states and other cities in terms of how their commercial real estate is doing? I mean, we've seen the reports, and the reports don't look good, but you guys are in the front lines, and obviously with corporations or exposure to all sorts of 55, I think you said, different groups in the United States. How does Atlanta compare?
I'll give you one look at it, and I've got a meeting Monday morning with a client of ours that we moved from Hartford, Connecticut. They moved their corporate headquarters here to Atlanta. We toured space yesterday. They moved in a year ago. We toured space yesterday, and it looks like they'll be taking more space because of it. If you really look, going back to your statement on location, if you look back at everything from the depth of the labor pool, the quality of the labor, the cost of living, the cost of commercial real estate, the pro-business environment from the state level, those are the things that companies look at. I know the Northeast, earlier in the year and the end of last year, they were increasing their corporate state taxes. A lot of corporations were taking a hard look at it, saying, gosh, why are we putting up with this anymore? And the answer is they will continue to look. And ultimately, Atlanta's in a great environment, basically becoming a catcher's mitt. Hartsfield Airport is one of the larger benefits for the state or for the city of Atlanta. Keep in mind, you can have national, global, or even regional companies here because their executives or their salespeople can be on a plane and be almost anywhere in the world in a short period of time.
Do you think the new international terminal does anything with regards to attracting the international kind of businesses?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the world, and we're going to a global economy, you know, New York is the financial center of the world, and it just so happens Atlanta's on the same timeline. So we are much better place to do business than in New York, and we're seeing people pick up and move here, and I think it's going to continue to happen. So, but to answer your question about how Atlanta compares to other markets, I was talking with our California partner yesterday in the Bay Area, and he said their business is booming. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of expansions going on. That's good news for the rest of us. Georgia, or Atlanta specifically, used to, before this 08 debacle, used to kind of lead the country. It was us in Washington, D.C. We were always number one in job growth, number one in office space growth. And we got hit very hard. And I think it's because Atlanta is a real estate market. We have a lot of companies that are involved in real estate, from a residential, mortgage, financial, development, engineering, architecture, the whole works. So it's really hit our market very hard. If we get some jobs here, have some companies relocate here, we'll be all right.
Let me dig a little bit deeper on one thing Kevin touched on. If you look at other markets around the country, you have to look at industry verticals. When you talk about the Bay Area, you have to look at software. Why is that? That's where the depth of the labor pool is, and that's where the talent is. If you look at Washington, D.C., Washington's an anomaly to the rest of the world because inside the Beltway, there is a money machine, an ATM that keeps on spitting it out.
Right.
Therefore, if you look at the industry that drives those markets, you will see that the dynamics are different. As Kevin had mentioned, real estate was more Atlanta, but Atlanta also started off as more of a region headquarter market. So why? The airport. Why? Its location with on the map.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at those and where those industries are and which industries are thriving, those are typically the markets that are doing well.
And this is a little bit an aside as well, but have you seen this whole concept of teleworking and the concept of working from home and obviously smaller entrepreneurs can get by with doing stuff at the house. Have you seen that impact, or have you noticed anything in a recovery back into corporate buildings and space be impacted at all by the ability to really run a business out of a garage?
I'll answer that. Several of our corporate clients over the last 4 or 5 years have cut their real estate holdings in half and kept their employees. So they're looking for other alternative ways to work. They may not necessarily work from home, but they're creating a mobile workforce and making it easier to do your work from wherever you are. So a couple of companies have done some studies, we call them butts in seats, to do an efficiency rating on how often somebody's actually in their seats. So it's really being looked at from the big corporations, much more so from an entrepreneurial standpoint. But I think you're going to see more and more people going to a mobile or some alternative workforce. There was a couple of companies that I met with 3 years ago that were looking at doing touchdown centers in the local communities. Rather than having their employees drive an hour into the corporate headquarters, they wanted to have a touchdown place that they could come back to and plug in, you know, for an hour or two until they could get in to get into a synergistic position with the rest of their employees.
Let me expand on that. I think that corporate America is still toying with that idea of hoteling. A lot of them are implementing it. I had a meeting 2 weeks ago in a very informal setting around a bar, you know, three bar stools and a bar table.
Hey, you know, great things are done around bar stools.
Well,
and bar tables.
And unfortunately, this was in their corporate space, so it was, you know, that's, they have open communal areas.
Right.
They all operate on laptops. They have closed conference rooms when they need those type of meetings. But I asked him if they were really locked into hoteling, and he said, no, we're still playing with it. So you have a lot of the individual psyche components that come into play. As Kevin mentioned, do you work from home? Well, then do you kind of lose touch with the people in your office? Or are you just sort of out there somewhere? You walk through the front door and then you scatter. You also, it's that collaborative effort that you tend to lose sometimes.
Right.
I'd like to just kind of add on that just from a different vantage point, and that's kind of the industrial real estate aspect of this discussion. And, you know, from a manufacturing or distribution standpoint, those users will continue to need space. And so, you know, and Atlanta is one of the top five markets for industrial real estate. So, you know, from a development standpoint, from an activity standpoint, this market is going to continue to have activity in that capacity.
Let me ask you guys this question, because I want to give our listeners a chance to self-identify and know if they're a good fit for you guys. Obviously, if I've got a CFO out there listening who's trying to figure out how to be cost-effective on profitability, we stated that pretty clearly. Hey, you should pick up the phone and call these guys. But is there another sweet spot for you guys? I mean, I don't know if businesses get too big or if they start off too small, but who's really your wheelhouse? Who's the business owner sitting out there that should pick up the phone and call you guys? Maybe what does he look like or what problems could he be having that says, I got to get the phone number at the end of the show and talk to these guys?
Go ahead, Tom.
Number one, it'd be for users of office and industrial space. And we now have an affiliation on the retail side that we would have those people fulfill those requirements. It's never too big, ever. We can accommodate, and we have some of the larger, you know, major corporations that we represent their footprint, both domestically and internationally. So it's never too large. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Is it too small? The answer is, what is the need? Is there a long-term benefit? I've had very small users of 2,000 feet that grew into 35,000-foot companies. One of the things that we love to hear about in the Atlanta paper are these upstart companies. Prior to the 08 fallout, we had the dot-com fallout. That was the tightest market I've ever seen in my 27-year career because you had companies coming out of the woodworks. We couldn't track them all. Why? Because they didn't exist 30 days ago. They were made up out of an idea and a meeting with an angel investor and then a VC, and poof, they needed 40,000 feet with the right to double in size in a six-month period. So it's never too small. It's the issue of, from our perspective, is there a referral there with somebody else that we can work with? You know, can we be causative? I had a call the other day from a doctor's practice, and we work with medical users as well. The gentleman called me up, said, I was referred to you. Here's where I am. I'm going to renew my lease. I just can't get the rate right. My answer to him was, look, we know the building extremely well, know the leasing agent. Go back and tell him this. And the answer was they just needed to reduce the rate by 50 cents, and the deal was done. They didn't need us to come in and tack on our fees on top of it. I said, look, in lieu of that, in lieu of the fee, just recommend me to somebody that you know. So, and I know there are brokers out there cringing when I say that, because our motto is do the right thing. The money just happens. The fees happen. And if we do the right thing for enough people, then the business will continue to grow. Unfortunately, the barriers of entry into our business are very low. It's not that hard to get a real estate license, and that's really all you need. And there's no differentiation between the residential side and the commercial side. And therefore, you have a lot of people that are chasing fees, not doing the right thing for the tenant. We look at ourselves as more of the marathon runner. We want to be here at the end of the day, not just race in, hoodwink somebody, get a large fee, and then, oops, what about our business practice?
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers your question.
Excellent, yes.
So we're going to wrap things up. So I'm going to finish with the last question. I'll kind of ask each of you. Tom, I'll start with you. We like to ask our listeners for a pearl of wisdom at the end of the show, just kind of a one last statement to kind of sum things up for our listeners. What would your pearl of wisdom be?
My pearl of wisdom would be get qualified advice and representation. Once again, we look at ourselves as consumer advocates, and the people that we hire pretty much have that in mind, and that's sort of in their DNA. Don't ever go into it thinking, gosh, well, it's going to cost me a fee. The landlord's already built the fee into the transaction. What you're ultimately doing is paying the landlord's agent more money to beat you up. Divorce attorneys, unfortunately, they're out there for a reason. So are insurance agents. You know, if you go to buy an insurance policy, you probably wouldn't be wise doing it on your own.
All right, perfect. Kevin?
I would say that the important thing for a client to understand is that the real estate is a strategic decision, with real estate being the number two large expense item next to payroll, that it plays a big part in their growth and their managing their business. And the other thing is to start early enough in looking at that and establish a relationship with an advocate. Much like you have a relationship with an attorney or an accountant that you rely on all the time. If you have this person, they become causative to your business. Our company will work with you on retainer at no cost and doing much pro bono work prior to getting paid. So it's very important for you to understand that there are folks out there that can do that.
Okay, Akiva?
Yeah, I will just wrap up with a small story. And Tom mentioned that there are, few barriers to entry into our industry. But what I do want to communicate is that there is a difference between having a commercial real estate professional operate on your behalf. And the story that I want to give is on the landlord side, I had a tenant that was looking at a property that we leased. We leased the property for about $23 a foot. And the client's budget was $18 a foot, which was a significant spread between what we were leasing the building for and what that client could afford to pay. We tried to figure out a way to make it work, and we ultimately could not make it work. This client had a residential agent representing them in the transaction. When we then moved to a different product type where we did a deal at $14 a foot for that client, and that client was ecstatic. Hey, my budget was $18 a foot. We got a deal for $14 a foot. My agent did a great job for me. Everything worked out well. Well, the reality of the situation was that building leased for $11 or $12 a foot. So that client ended up paying $3 more a foot for a property that they should have gotten for less money. So there is a difference between a commercial real estate professional and a real estate agent.
All right. So from a contact information standpoint, I'll just check with each of you. Tom, if somebody wants to reach out and chat with you, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
I would imagine just Google my name. I mean, that's probably the easiest route. Or go to Cresa.com, which is Cresa.com, and click on the Atlanta location. You can pull up all of our contact information as well as our profiles.
Okay. Kevin, do you have any other a phone number or anything, or just that, that's easiest?
Same. That's the same. Yeah, Cresa.com.
Okay. And Akiva, I would imagine the same thing for you.
Yeah. Well, Tom and Kevin are much bigger fish than I am, so I'm going to give my number. 404-446-1863 is my direct dial.
Okay. So I appreciate you guys coming out and taking some time with us this morning. Certainly learned a lot about the commercial real estate business. For our listeners, we appreciate your time and your attention. We hope that you have a great week. And until then, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.